Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by Eating Tools, unique handmade eating and cooking tools. For more information, visit eatingtools.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. It's 2017.
Woohoo!
And this is our 200th show.
Yeah.
So we're happy about that. We're glad to be back on. Yes. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Thank you for the applause. This is going to be the best show.
The bigly. It's going to be bigly. It's a bigly new year.
It's huge.
Studio audience is really excited.
Yes, it is.
The paid studio audience.
I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are the ladies of Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And our show aims to bring culture to horticulture. So
today we are starting a big grand tour.
A grand tour of the United States. But first we want to say the show is now on Tuesdays, 1:15 to 2:15, an hour-long format, which gives us more time to research, to produce the shows, and bring you interesting content. So as Alice said, we have a running theme through this whole year. And the theme is land, climate, and zones.
Envy.
Zone envy. So we wanted to focus on the United States. Last year was a rough year, a very divisive year.
Yeah.
And we want to move forward and share stories about gardeners, farmers, botanists, happening throughout the United States, because everybody gardens everywhere.
From coast to coast.
Yes. And we'll include the interior, of course.
Of course. That's where the best stuff happens.
Yeah. So each show is going to focus on one or more USDA zone and the people and places that make it unique, except for the show, which is going to cover two zones.
Right. Today's show.
Exactly. And we're going to also share stories additionally weekly on our blog.
Right. WeDigPlantsPodcast.com.
So we had to find an organizing principle to divide up the United States. So we decided to use the new, relatively new, 2012 USDA, that is United States Department of Agriculture, map. This map was published, and it reflects the weather in the United States. And in this latest edition of the map, a very complex algorithm was used to better analyze the weather data from different stations. So just like the previous maps, it divides the country into different zones, and now they're numbered from 1 through 13, and with half zones as well. Gardeners and nurserymen and people in horticulture are familiar with this, but a lot of people aren't.
Right.
You know? So these zones basically tell you what the minimum temperatures are on average in that zone. And there's like a 10 degree range in each zone, and then a 5 degree range in the half zone.
Right, and some states actually have two or three.
Or more.
Zones, or maybe more, depending on altitude and elevation.
Exactly. And so it's climate, it's geography. So, for example, here in Brooklyn, Alice and I garden in zone 7B. That means that on average, the coldest it gets in our zone is 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Not warm enough for my lemon trees to stay outdoors. but great for lots of other plants.
But amazing for rhododendrons.
Yes, exactly. So this is the map that growers and gardeners and, like I said, anyone that works in horticulture uses to determine what they can grow where. It's like a guide to your patch of earth.
That's right.
Right? So when you buy a plant, a lot of times if it's a good tag, if it's a good plant identification tag, it'll tell you its hardiness zone. So you can decide, can you grow it here? Is it a tropical that you have to bring in, etc.?
Uh-huh.
So I love maps, and I always have loved maps. In fact, one of the best parts of road trips for me is studying the map while somebody else is driving and looking for weird town names and unusual features.
Honestly,
right?
If I could go back to school, I would go back and study cartography.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, I love GPS. I love the Google Maps. I really love that. But there's nothing
like a big old foldable paper map.
Yeah. So, and this map, the USDA map in particular, is very close to my heart because it's based on data that respects no political boundaries, no state lines, no town limits, no congressional districts.
That's right.
It's geography.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, it's land. It's nature.
The real equalizer.
The real equalizer. So this map is based on weather from 1976 to 2005, taken from 7,900 weather stations throughout the United States. And it was used, because I want to do a shout out to the people that have created this, it was used, was created by a climate mapping technology called PRISM, P-R-I-S-M, that was developed at Oregon State University in Corvallis. And all this data, a lot of it actually, is available for free to the public. And you can go to their site, and we're going to post about it on our blog, plug in your location and get data going back to 1895 for your county. Which is really cool.
Yep.
So besides being able to examine plant hardiness zones at a much, much finer scale than ever before, this latest map added two new zones, zones 12 and 13, that cover basically Hawaii and Puerto Rico. And
hot.
Yes, very hot. So according to the USDA website, adding these two new zones will provide a way to share information about differences in cold sensitivity for tropical ornamental plants, which most of us, of course, in the continental United States use as houseplants or patio plants. So when the temperatures start to fall, you will know how long you can wait before you bring in the ginger plant. Or you can test the plant's boundaries like I did and kill it, which is what I did to my beautiful ginger plant this year because I waited too long.
Well, we had such a nice warm
fall. Oh, yeah. And I was like, let's see. And yeah. I have a little bit of a sadomasochistic streak, so I sometimes stretch my plants. Thank you, Dave. Anyway, so today we're going to talk about the two zones. We're going to start with our good friend, Scott Appel, calling in from Vieques, Puerto Rico, who gardens in Zone 13. And then on the third part of the show, we're going to have a couple of guests from... one guest from Hawaii, from the Botanical Garden, the National Tropical Botanical
Hawaii's
Garden.
Hawaii's National Tropical Botanical Garden. Tobias Kohler.
Okay, so stay on the line. After our break, we're going to bring Scott on, and we're going to talk about Zone 13.
Thank you.
Hi, Scott. How are you today? Hi, Scott. Can you hear us?
Hello.
Hi, Scott.
Carmen.
Hi, it's Alice and Carmen. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Oh, what's my favorite horticultural gal pal?
How are you?
Hi, Carmen and Alice. Hope you're holding up.
We are.
We're doing well. We are talking about Zone 13 today, and being that you live in Puerto Rico, and Zone 13 was just added to the USDA map, we thought you'd be the perfect person to talk about growing and horticulture in that zone.
Oh, well, I'm honored. The connection is a little scratchy.
Okay.
So if I say, I'm sorry, what did you say? You know, you have to be patient, please.
Sure. No. Absolutely. Well, just to, Scott has been on our show numerous times, and just to give a little background for those who haven't, who are new listeners, he, besides being a horticultural taxonomist and growing extraordinary plants in his garden, Vieques, he's also a talented baker and cook, custom making everything from rolls to wedding cakes. So Scott has his hand in a lot of different things there in Vieques.
A lot of beautiful things.
Beautiful things. And he moved from New York City to Vieques, Puerto Rico, about 10 years ago, and has a wealth of experience in growing things in that zone. So, Scott, tell us what it was like to go.
I'm hearing music.
Oh, yes, we're trying to get you in the mood.
We're getting you in the Puerto Rican mood because you don't live there.
We're getting ourselves in the Puerto Rican mood because we want to be there right now. So anyway, Scott, tell us a little bit about what it was like to go from temperate zone, New York City, to the tropics, kind of all at once, and also describe like what the landscape was like when you arrived there and were building the house and making the gardens.
Number one, I always knew I would live. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, perfectly.
Okay. Oh, okay. I always knew somehow in my heart of hearts, even as a kid, I'd live in some place warm. I hate the cold. Even though I played in the snow as a kid, I never knew I'd be living down here.
Right.
Remember, I was... Oh, and there's my chickens. I was director of horticulture for the St. George Village Botanical Garden on St. Croix.
Yeah.
So when I left the Horticultural Society of New York and moved there, it was a total shock. It was the best thing I ever did, but a total shock. Just the way things were so slow. It wasn't Manhattan anymore. And then, of course, I moved here, and my partner moved here. And
I'm loving these chickens.
I do, Scott.
I'm sorry, what?
I love the chickens.
Oh. Well, I get fresh eggs every day. Anyway... So, well, it's totally different. The landscape here on Vieques looks like Africa because of all the acacia trees that grow here and all of the leucodendron trees that grow here. These were brought up, or those were brought over by settlers, you know, in the 1500s. They're leguminaceous, meaning, you know, the pea family.
Right.
So they have those nitrogen-fixating nodules on their roots. So they brought them over from Africa. And they took over the island.
Uh-huh.
Remember, this is very complex. Remember that Vieques, up until the 1941... was a sugarcane plantation, the entire island.
Wow.
What was graded up and planted with sugarcane. Then come 1941, everything collapsed. and these African plants took over the island. And I was actually quoted in a magazine, our local magazine. We were driving around, the editor and myself, and I said, you know, if I saw a zebra or a giraffe, it would be perfectly normal.
Right.
But the vegetation is abnormal. They're all invasive native species. And, of course, they brought them over because of, you know, the nitrogen-fixating qualities. But also, you know, they fed cattle.
Right.
Cows eat them. Horses eat them. Pigs eat them. But meanwhile, the native flora, there is native flora, and the list is humongous. It's all on the endangered species list because the entire island was dug up.
Right.
To plant sugarcane.
Right. So what were some of the things that were dug up?
Do you have a sense of what was native, Scott, that was removed or that, you know?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, but no one will really know unless they're like in the Cactus Club and really specialists. But for example, in the Cactus Department, Harissa puertoricensis, Hugo Jumbo, meaning spiny fig, that's an endangered cactus. It was Leptoceras bratanias. A major one is Melocactus and tortoise. It's a Turk's cap. It looks like something you might have sold way back when at the gift shop, you know, at the Horticultural Society. You know, round globoid with ribs, with a sticky up thing. They call that the cephalia, and you know that means head. And people dig them up and sell them, or take them home and plant them. In fact, the last thing I did before I left the Botanical Garden on St. Croix, a dozen of them were confiscated by the officials because somebody was trying to ship them out. He or she had dug them up.
Right, right.
And, of course, it was my job to plant them. You can't just throw them out. They're endangered. You know, so endangered cactus lots. But, you know, we have our own species of boxwood.
Really?
Boxes valley. Diabolito de Tres Cuernos. There's no English names for these plants. The little devil with three horns. We have our own species of magnolia. Magnolia splendens. Of course, splenda means splendid. We know that, but the flowers are really small. We have our own species of ilex, holly. We have our own species of pine tree, Pinus caribbea, and Thuja caribbea, arborvitae. You know, so you could actually have a Tudor garden with a topiary, if you felt, with tropical topiary, if you felt like it.
Right.
But all of our really native species are on the brink because everything has been dug up.
Right,
right, right. And when you and I speak often, Scott, we talk about the weather, right? And we talk about the weather in New York versus Vieques. Can you describe for our listeners kind of what the weather pattern is like there and the seasons and precipitation, what kind of makes Vieques unique in that regard?
Unique, bizarre might be a better word.
Okay.
Global warming has affected us just like the rest of the world. When we moved here, and that was 14 years ago.
Wow.
And the weather patterns were normal. Remember, the rainy season is June 15th to November 15th. That's hurricane season. The rainy season, that's when tourists don't come.
Right.
The dry season is November 15th, you know, back to, you know, June. It's totally reversed. We got enormous torrential rains in November, December. That's
wow.
completely unusual. And now it's dry, dry, dry.
Hmm.
Which it should, well, you know, technically it should be, but really dry. There's not an inch of rain.
Right.
Yeah, when we speak, you often talk about how dry it is.
And tell us, tell me, Scott, I've been to some of the other Caribbean islands, but do you have much elevation in Vieques?
I'm sorry, dear, say that again.
Elevation, please. Mountains. Do you have, like, is it mountainous or is it more arid and dry, flat?
No, there is one mountain. Monte Pirata, in fact, meaning Pirate Mountain. I don't know how high it is. It really is not very high.
Okay.
The Vieques is really flat.
Okay. Okay.
You know, basically.
Uh-huh. I was just wondering if you had much altitude that would affect wind patterns or, you know.
Oh, I see what you're saying. All of our rain comes from the north.
No.
Remember, we're an island off the southeast coast uh-huh. of the main island of Puerto Rico.
Right.
The main island of Puerto Rico has El Junque, the rainforest.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All our rain really comes down south to us, or it comes from North Africa and comes, you know,
straight across.
I guess,
right.
Westwardly, you know.
Yeah.
So our water comes from the main island,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so when you water your plants, it comes through pipes under the canal of Vieques, through pipes, because we get so little water, especially now. Last year, there was the worst drought in 66 years.
Wow.
And, of course, there were people old enough, you know, to remember that.
Right.
They stopped. You can't water cars. You can't water your lawn. You can't, you know, hose off your stoop. You could water, you know, comestible plants. That was allowed.
Okay.
But it carried on for months, six months. They blocked the water. And in the main island, they stop restaurants from having the water. How can you have a restaurant or a hotel with no water?
Right.
So, you know, so the climate change has become, I don't know, drastic from when we first visited and bought land and then finally moved here.
Right.
So have you had to adjust what you can grow? We've talked about a little bit about native plants and that are now endangered and things that were brought indigenously. But you grow a lot of different things, Scott, from edibles, herbs,
fruits
and tropicals. So have you
uh-huh.
tell us a little bit about what you grow and how you've had to adapt to this climate change that's happened on the island?
I have to water. A lot of my herbs are Mediterranean.
Right.
Rosemary. Or Mexican, the Mexican marigold that is a tarragon substitute.
Mm-hmm.
Mexican oregano, also Mexican. They're in clay pots. Sometimes I have to water them twice a day. That's a lot.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
Of course, you know, but they're in, you know, 20-inch clay pots.
Wow.
That's a big clay pot.
Mm-hmm.
And water them twice a day. And
these are plants that don't like to be watered. So that's really saying something.
That tells you how dry it is.
Right.
And I'm so busy baking, I haven't watered in days. So I'm afraid to even walk outside. I shouldn't even be saying that. But, you know, because I'm so busy.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's so dry.
Mm-hmm.
And the orchids, well, you know, they hold on. Things do hold on, but
do you catch any of the water from the rain, Scott? Do you do any collection and saving?
Oh, well,
cistern?
Of course, dear. Okay. No, we've got huge cisterns.
Okay, so that's good.
You know,
that's
so good. I can just turn the tap on and just collect water.
Right.
It's not, you know, we of course we pay for water here.
Sure.
And everything is probably six times more expensive than the States. But no, we have huge cisterns. And so I can, you know, take a watering can and you just turn on the spigot and there it is. So, you know, that's not a problem, but it's all the time. And, you know, it's full-time gardening. And so.
Tell us about some of the indigenous plants that you grow that you've incorporated into your gardens.
Indigenous? Ooh, that's a bad question. That really is a bad question.
We won't tell.
I mentioned I
right.
do have.
Okay.
I do have some of our native orchids.
Oh, yes.
We have a native vanilla.
Uh-huh.
Vanilla cucullata. The pods are considered so inferior, they're considered really inedible. But I've got it. Mm-hmm. I have some other indigenous orchids. Of course, you have to remember, and we've spoken about this in the past, collecting orchids from the wild is strictly illegal.
Yes.
These from finding pieces will end like driftwood on the beach or,
sure.
you know, right. or a gift or a piece from somebody else, this or that.
Right.
Really indigenous, I don't really have any. Everyone comes here and goes, ooh, and takes lovely photographs of all the beautiful tropical flora. We have beautiful tropical flowers, but they're all from other countries.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about that, Scott. Because when in our discussions, we talked about how it's difficult sometimes to get things shipped to Puerto Rico.
Right.
So how do you get some of your plants? Are there nurseries there that supply some? Or, you know, do some nurseries ship mail order? You know, why is it difficult? Are there restrictions or is it just that, you know, there isn't enough demand? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there are major constrictions because the main states consider Puerto Rico a foreign country.
Okay.
That's the biggest problem. And okay. that happens with so many mail order companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have nurseries here.
Yes.
In fact, Carmen, you know, when you visited, we might have gone to a couple. I don't remember, really.
Yes, I think.
So some of them, you know, well, they all have plants. It just depends on what you want.
Yes, right.
You cannot ship plants down.
Okay.
You have to ship them bare root.
Okay.
With notification and certification, et cetera, et cetera. However, if I wanted to take anything up to the States, and I mean anything. and I've grown mangroves, you know, in aquariums under lights in Manhattan where we used to live.
Yes.
You can take anything you want. You can't bring it down. It's such a bugaboo.
So if you came to the mainland, you couldn't bring yourself, you couldn't bring plants down. You have to use a nursery that is inspected, and and they have to be willing to ship to Puerto Rico because it's considered a foreign country.
I would have to have them ship to a friend in the States, like my sister, for example, who would then reship it down to me.
I see.
But if it's a bare root plant, I mean, and it's Puerto Rico.
Yes.
You know, would it live?
Right, right.
Would it arrive intact?
Right,
yeah.
But we, Puerto Rico has a wonderful, what would you call it, horticultural show.
Oh, they do.
It's not like the Pennsylvania,
right.
you know, flower show. It's in Ay Benito. Avenida in Spanish. Oh, how lovely. It's in the upper west hand part of the main island of Puerto Rico. Well, once a year, in the early July, for 2 weeks, there's a flower show. But, of course, I would have to fly there, then rent a car to get there. So, you know, it's sort of cost prohibitive, but you can get really great plants, all kinds of orchids. In fact, one of my rarest plants came from there. And that is, you would call it a myrmophytic plant. Myrmophytic, that means, well, in Latin, botanical Latin, ant plant. I've had it for about 4 years. It has a big caudex. For those succulent lovers who are listeners of yours, that means a plant with a giant, fat basal stem.
Yes.
Okay?
Sure.
And it's called myrmophytic because it has holes in that giant caudex. It's caudiciform. But the caudex is that big fat part. And this is probably twice the size of a grapefruit.
Wow.
But it's full of holes. But it's full of holes. It's epiphytic. It's from Java.
Wow.
And myrmophytic means, as I said, ant plant. And the holes invite fertile queen ants to enter and have an instant ant colony because the whole caudex is full of tunnels.
Oh, fun.
That is an amazing adaptation.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. Scott, can you send us a picture of that plant? I'd love to post about it after the show and share it, because I doubt that anybody else listening is growing that.
No, I'd love to see a picture of that.
Oh, no, I'd love to, and it's so easy from seed.
Oh.
And but the most important part of it, and of course, you know, it's odd looking. It's not like it's beautiful, although all plants are intrinsically beautiful.
Naturally.
Our native ants have inhabited it.
Oh.
So even here.
Uh-huh.
All those miles away from Java, the ants got the picture.
Everybody finds a home, right?
Exactly. Well, Scott, we could talk for hours about this, but unfortunately, we don't have any more time. But
I know, dear.
It was a brief one today. But
thank you for giving us a little insight.
Yeah, into Zone 13, which is where we want to be right now.
Yes.
Because it's so cold in New York.
I wish you were here, and thank you so much for having me again. And be well. And
we will talk soon.
Thank you.
We'll
talk again. Thanks for sharing so much knowledge, Scott. Take care.
Bye.
So we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to Hawaii. Stay tuned.
I went down to North Carolina. Realized there was surely nothing finer. Hopped into a tiny highway diner. Met the daughter of an old coal miner. She said,
inspired by the finely crafted tools built at the hands of friends in and around custom knife making, and with a love of all things food, Abe Shaw began forging a collection of culinary tools unlike any other. Collecting and working with custom and handmade knives for over a decade, Abe has developed a deep respect and admiration for the artists, metalsmiths, woodworkers, and craftspeople behind the endless interpretations of these ancient tools that feed us, the most intimate tools in our lives. They needed a showcase, and Eating Tools was born. The curated collection of unique and extraordinary handmade culinary utensils you'll find here, along with a hand-picked selection of top-quality production-made pieces, represents a catalog of products never before assembled in one place. Many of these products can only be found at Eating Tools. Food, cooking, craftsmanship, and art are their ingredients. There's no substitute for having the right tool for the job, and Eating Tools promises to bring you just that. They think you'll agree that the food-loving visionaries behind each of their products has an eye for the tools we use every day. For more information, visit eatingtools.com.
Hello, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today, Carmen and I are talking about the USDA map. We're kicking off our new theme for the year. So once a month, we're going to go to a different zone. Today, we're talking about zone 12 and 13. We were just in Puerto Rico. So get on a virtual airplane with us, and now we're going to go to Hawaii.
Yes.
Because it's January, and everybody needs a little Hawaii in January. So we are going to talk...
I'm sorry. That is not a valid extension. Please try...
We are going to talk with the National Tropical Botanical Garden in Hawaii. And while we're getting our guest on the line, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the National Tropical Botanical Garden. It's the only tropical botanical garden with a charter from the United States Congress. Federal charters for private nonprofit entities, such as the NTBG charter, have been granted by Congress only rarely, and then only in the circumstance, or only in the circumstance that a compelling case has been made to Congress that the proposed organization will serve as an important national and public need. So the history of the charter. In the early 1960s, a group of forward-thinking individuals recognized the need for a tropical botanical garden on U.S. soil. An impressive group of organizations and individuals banded together to form a foundation with the purpose of ensuring that such a garden was established and with the objective that the Congress of the United States should issue the charter for this institution. An extensive investigation was conducted before the bill was presented for the vote. It included a feasibility study by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, a hearing before the Judiciary Committee of the House of Representatives, reports from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of the Interior, and other federal agencies and offices, reports to the members of Congress endorsing the legislation from the Judiciary Committee and the House of Representatives and from the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. So in August 1964, finally, legislation enacted Public Law 88-449, which gave a charter to the Botanic Garden, chartering the Act of Congress... Chartered by the Act of Congress, the Pacific Tropical Botanical Garden. The bill, when first introduced, proposed the name National Tropical Botanical Garden. However, the U.S. Department of Agriculture suggested as one of the alternatives the name Pacific Tropical Botanical Garden. Subsequently, in 1988, Congress amended this charter legislation and changed the name to the National Tropical Botanical Garden.
Sounds better.
Yes. So it has it's a combination of several gardens. It has a living collection, a herbarium, and a library. So I think we have our guest on the phone at this point, Tobias. Hi.
Hi, this is Tobias with the National Tropical Botanical Garden. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I was just giving a little introduction onto the history of the charter and how you all came about and started to talk about the living collections. So why don't we hear from, in your words, tell us about the living collections and what you all do as a kind of conglomeration botanical garden.
Sure, thank you. So the National Tropical Botanical Garden has what we call living collections spread across each of its five gardens, four of which are in the state of Hawaii. And living collections are much like a museum in the sense that we collect plants from across the Pacific and tropical regions, and we house them in our gardens with all the collection information, all the scientific, the names and where they were collected from, and we maintain what we call provenance data for each of the plants so that they can be studied. And so the idea is you can study the plants in one place in a garden, and then sometimes you can go out into the field into their original habitat and do comparisons. Or, in many cases, we are rescuing plants into our collections, and then we maintain them here until such a time as we can return them to their original habitats.
Right.
Well, that's extraordinary. I think a lot of people don't realize that that happens with plants. They're familiar with that with animals, uh-huh. but it's really amazing work that you're doing with the probably some endangered species, I would imagine.
Yeah. And so, Hawaii is known as the endangered species capital of the world.
Right.
And of roughly the 1,200 or so native plant species, several hundred are actually endangered, and that's actually holding a legal status. Mm-hmm. And then there are several hundred more that are threatened in some way but don't have a protected status yet. And so we're working right on the cutting edge of these really rare plants and making sure that, first of all, that they're cataloged, and second, that they are, we can assure their existence in perpetuity.
Yeah. Can you tell us about your specific, the garden that you're at, the McBride Garden?
Yeah. So of the five gardens, two of them are found on the south shore of Kauai, the McBride Garden and the Allerton Garden. The McBride Garden is our research and conservation garden, including the surrounding preserve areas. It's about 250 acres, and we have over 6,000 plant species in the gardens. And every single plant in the garden has a tag on it with kind of a serial number, and it's cataloged. We do have a visitor program that allows the public to come in and explore the garden on their own, but it is also maintained to the highest standards. We have a whole living collections policy, in fact, so that researchers from all around the world can come here and study plants, some of which no longer actually exist in the wild anymore.
Right. Tell us about that unique environment, because today we're talking about zones. So
yes, that's right.
Can you tell us about your zone and how amazing it is compared to
sure.
New York City?
Right. Okay. So as many of your listeners are very much aware, in Hawaii we have very much like most tropical regions, there is a growing season and then there's another growing season. In fact, there is growing season all year long.
Right.
It is somewhat seasonal, so we're right on the edge of the tropics, and so it's best characterized by a wet season and a drier season. And being on the south shore of Kauai in a valley, so all the islands have a wetter side and a drier side, and we're on the drier side.
Mm-hmm.
And that presents a unique set of challenges for plants. I mean, we are able to trick plants a little bit and, tuck them away against cliff faces and things like that with more shade and adding water to create more of their natural environment in that sense. But that said, it's on the drier side. But the beauty of the National Tropical Botanical Garden and its gardens across the state, we have gardens located in other wetter environments as well. For example, mm-hmm. the Limahuli Garden on the north shore of Kauai, and the Kahanu Garden out in Hana, Maui, which is all the way out east. And so between all those locations, we can pretty much cover all the montane wet, the kind of intermediate mesic forest, mm-hmm. as well as the leeward side drier environments. And lastly, the coastal strand. Pretty much the only thing we can't do is the, the mountaintop kind of Arctic
right.
type environment found
sure.
on the tops of Haleakala and Mauna Kea.
Yeah. When I was in Kauai, I spent about a month there. Oh my God, at Millennium. I went for the Millennium. And I went to Limahuli. And of course, I fell in love. And I, we hiked all through Waimea Canyon. And the altitude, the variety on that one hike, the variety of plant material that I witnessed and experienced was so amazing. Because it went from, I can't remember the height. It was 10,000 feet down to sea level. And so all of a sudden you are in, like you said, the mountaintop, you're on this arid Arctic, and then you're down through the wet, you know, rainforest down at sea level. It is unbelievable what you all are doing and preserving, because I was just blown away by the variety of material.
Yeah, people need to get away from the beaches and come into the interior and see. I mean, just looking at the USDA map, right, uh-huh. of Hawaii, it looks like there are like four or five zones difference. There's big temperature differences
yes.
between the coast, you know, along
it's
the water.
It's wet and dry, and it's then, the wettest place on Earth. Right? Is that right, Tobias?
This is very interesting. I mean, I've been in Hawaii for 16 years now, and it never ceases to amaze. It's exactly the way you're describing it, where
yeah.
we have these very wet, I mean, receiving meters upon meters upon meters of rainfall at the highest peaks of the island of Kauai, which is at about 4,000, just over 4,000 feet, or maybe a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And then, it, as you've described, exactly, it moves through wetter forest zones, getting progressively drier as you get closer to the shoreline. One thing that I did want to point out, and that's just as important component of what we're about, is we're also in the business of preserving the cultural story and value behind each of the plants and the places that we're in. And so a lot of people don't always think about that, where we have a plant, and inherent to this very rare or unique plant are scientific qualities that we want to preserve, but there oftentimes is there's a story, there is folklore, there is mm-hmm. a cultural component to that plant, be it a historic use for, say, as a medicine, or just a story that, you know, that kids grew up hearing their parents tell and pass down through the generations. So we're in the business of preserving the stories as well as the scientific integrity of the plant.
See, everything about Hawaii is warm. The people, the culture, the stories, the temperature. It is just the most inviting.
It's a very
gorgeous.
I've never been, and every person that goes there,
it will transform your life.
Yeah,
this is the zone that I and I thought of something, but I can't think of it right now. I mean, think of who. Well. I mean, this is a whole.
Well, there's also history too,
right?
You know?
Exactly.
And let me ask you:
who traveled there? The Scots, right?
Yeah,
talk about plantsmen,
missionaries,
right?
But so, do you delve at all into the economic botany side of it too, and that cultural piece?
And so, this is what a great question. And so, the economic botany and kind of the agroforestry piece is also integrated into the work we do. And so. I like to describe our five gardens and say they're kind of analogous to the five different, the main Hawaiian islands. And each island has kind of a different culture and different character or different personality.
Mm-hmm.
And each of our gardens have a different personality as well. And so I talked about how the McBride Garden is our research and conservation garden. But kind of an umbrella over all of that is our Breadfruit Institute. And that is taking on, you know, head on, taking on the questions of feeding populations, for
yes.
example. And so we have breadfruit collections. The primary collection is actually in our Kahanu Garden in East Maui. And we have backup collections in our other gardens in case of catastrophic events.
Wow.
Our Breadfruit Institute is in the business of studying the over 150 varieties of breadfruit out there, identifying which varieties have the most nutrition, and it's fundamentally, and there's I'm not going to claim all the credit. There are some other organizations out there trying to solve world hunger, but we are also in that business, specifically having to do with the breadfruit. We are partnered with groups that distribute breadfruit trees, and you know, within 3 or 4 years, a tree will go into production, and then it's capable of feeding a family of four.
Wow!
And this is, I mean, this it's a fundamental, game-changing solution to kind of sustainability and food, I mean, you know, feeding mankind, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in the process in the McBride Garden. In fact, we'll probably roll it out this year, of converting our existing breadfruit orchard, which is more traditional in that it is planted in rows, mm-hmm. into an agroforestry demonstration project, getting at exactly what your question was about, which is the economic botany, where we show and we will train farmers and interested researchers on methods for converting their existing orchard-type setups into a more sustainable mixed planting. So different plants will be fruit trees will be intermingled with the breadfruit trees as proof that it can be done,
right?
And it's the way to go. So yes, very exciting.
And can you tell us some of the kind of cultural stories? Like, for instance, the name Limahuli. Can you tell us, like, that garden is further up north in Kauai? But can you tell us the cultural kind of story about that?
You know what? I can't tell you specifically about Limahuli, and forgive me for that.
It's helping.
Just, I have to study, but I study up on that a little bit. But the concept, I can speak of it at a higher level, is it's called, there's this system called the Ahupua'a system, and that's a mouthful to those who haven't heard it before. And the concept is that Polynesians, the first arriving Polynesians, divided up the islands by watershed. And so from the top of the mountain, and it was bounded by the ridge lines as you descended from the mountain, and it went until about waist deep into the water, you'd have this Ahupua'a, and it's essentially each valley would be a, there would be a village, or so to speak, is kind of an analogy to it, and there would be an organized system of who was in charge and rules. And basically, each Ahupua'a strove to be self-sustaining, and or where a certain Ahupua'a was lacking in a resource or another, it was there were trade that would happen across the valleys. And so as you visit Hawaii, you'll notice that each valley actually has a name. And it's not really just about the stream that goes down the valley. It's more about the entire place and kind of the sustainable living situation that was established in managing the land in a way that it could last and be used in perpetuity. So, and that is kind of a really powerful concept. If you take the, if you zoom out a little bit and you, you know, we're on an island, the nearest landmass is 2,500 miles away, and, you know, we're in a lifeboat.
Yes.
And
yeah.
We gotta use our resources very carefully, and the Hawaiians perfected that to absolution. I mean, which is really, really neat.
Wow.
I believe Limahuli, I think, meant helping hands. I believe, and there was, and like the taro scene, because that's where a lot of the taro, taro plant. Terracing is, right? So it was a matter of turning the soil over, right, and reaching the inner depths of the earth to kind of fertilize. Is that, that's what I remember from my kind of cultural reading.
You're spot on in the sense that just like, you know, if you were studying a foreign language and you were trying to piece together how did that word come together,
right?
Lima, so the word huli is to kind of to roll or to turn over.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you're in a canoe and you huli, it means that you flipped your canoe. And so it's exactly what you're the way you're describing it, which is, and I don't know the other component of it, but it rings true the way you describe it. And the thing you're talking about, the plant you're talking about, this taro, you know, this is, you know, one of the key and extremely culturally, as well as kind of from a food crop standpoint, very important plant. And they were planted in these terraced systems that had water flowing through them. And Limahuli has functioning lo'i, those are these water terraces that we are describing, and water flows gradually through them, and the terraces at Limahuli are original. They're still fully functional.
Wow.
You know, and they're you know, they're centuries old at this point. And there are, you know, there are other examples still around the state, but on Kauai, the ones at Limahuli are just it's a powerful place. It is a yeah. very moving experience to go there.
It's spiritual. It's very spiritual. Yeah. Can you tell us some of the future plans for the garden and how the public can help? I'm a little nervous about all this administration change. And, you know, we obviously we don't have details yet about what's going to happen to some of our protected land and monies. So tell us how the public can help you and what your future plans are.
Thank you so much for asking that. And you know what? Our founders, and I didn't catch the beginning of your introduction because we were playing a little bit of phone technology stuff.
Right.
But our founders were visionaries. And NTBG is a nonprofit that is not funded by the government. We receive some grants here and there, but that's very temporary and passing. And so we operate in the realm of, you know, much like many institutions, reliant on, you know, endowments, donations, memberships, and we are very grateful if you join us for a visit and pay your admission fee. Some of the bigger plans for the gardens, and I want to talk about, you know, give everybody a fair shake in this. In the McBride Garden this year, this summer, we're refreshing our canoe garden where we're going to showcase the 27 plants that Polynesians brought with them in their canoes.
Oh.
And we're actually going to construct lo'i there as a way to just show off a little bit of what it was like. It's not going to be nearly as majestic as Limahuli. I want to just move up to Limahuli really quick. Limahuli actually has a preserve in addition to the garden at the mouth of the valley. And their public involvement involves, you know, volunteering, helping. You know, we're trying to make that garden a lot more accessible and make the paths a lot more user-friendly. And so there's some projects surrounding that right now. We're also in the business of eradicating pests, including rats, goats, pigs, from the preserve areas, in addition to the restoration work we do there.
Mm-hmm.
Out at Kahanu, which is in East Maui, they have the breadfruit collection, but they also have the largest collection of taro in one place in the state.
Mm.
And the kind of help they need there really is also in volunteering, coming to pay a visit. And then we're looking at projects where we need help. And this is, you know, a big ask, of course. Both Limahuli and Kahanu are looking to upgrade their visitor center so that people launch off into their excursion into the gardens better equipped to have a powerful experience.
Right.
So that's kind of where we're at in the gardens in Hawaii.
Do you also, I was reading on your website, do you, and I was, I, as part of my intro, I was talking about the charter that you all received from the government. And do you also have a garden in Florida?
So that's, and isn't that a great story too? So the fifth garden is called the Kampong, and it's in the Coconut Grove area of Miami.
Yeah.
And it is the former home of David Fairchild, a world-renowned plant collector, and actually right down the road is the Fairchild Botanical Garden.
Uh-huh.
But I digress. The Kampong is a great garden in right there in the heart of Miami, and it is its focus is also on economic botany. We work closely with Florida International University. It is home to our Institute for ICTB. Anyhow, it's an institute studying tropical botany, and it is also heavily focused, going back to where we earlier conversation we were having, on economic botany, focusing on things like mangoes and avocados, as well as some of just the rarest oddities that Dr. Fairchild collected from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And Fairchild spent some time in Hawaii, too, is that right?
You bet. And so, you know, he, and I don't know all of his, I mean, he trekked all over the world.
Right.
But, yes, he spent a long stint in Hawaii collecting and, as well as contributing to the collections, some of which we have access to, and I can't go into any further detail, honestly, sure. because I haven't studied up on that yet either.
And I believe he's buried in Maui. I could be wrong, but I thought
that sounds right.
That's what, and that's why I hesitated earlier because I couldn't quite remember. But I believe he's buried at the Hana on the Trail to Hana, which is another.
He's not the only dead botanist.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
A few of them ended up there.
What a way to go!
That's not a bad way to go.
Yeah. Well, thank you for shedding some light on your zone and the important work that you do. And I just really beg everybody to go spend some time with you all because Hawaii and the preservation work that you're doing is really great. And I know there's a rumor going around that President Obama is going to be doing a lot of saving of species in your neck of the woods. So
I hope that's true.
Hopefully that will come your way.
Thank you for the opportunity, and really, we're a very special organization. We are very unique in what we do, and like I mentioned towards the beginning, we're working on the forefront, I mean, on the cutting edge of research and conservation, as well as preserving the cultural knowledge of plants. And if any of you or your listeners are ever in Hawaii, please do give us a ring or stop by. There's a little bit something for everybody, I promise. We didn't even dabble in some of the other aspects of the garden.
I know.
That we'll have to save for another time.
Can you give our listeners the link to the website so they can click right on it? What is
You bet. It's an easy one to remember. ntbg.org.
Oh, that's very
easy. NationalTropicalBotanicalGarden.org. ntbg.org is the way to go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Mahalo.
Thank you, guys.
Mahalo.
Yes, mahalo. Aloha.
Aloha.
Well, thank you for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. This was our 200th episode. I hope that you enjoyed it. Stay with us throughout this whole year. We're going to be traveling across the United States.
It's a virtual road trip.
It's a virtual road trip. And, of course, you can get more information and follow us on all the social media platforms, including our new blog, which is WeDigPlantsPodcast.com. Thanks for listening. See you in the garden.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. I also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.